I will tell you that there is evidence that supports the claim that the world is only 6,000 years old. And I say that this is what blows the minds of many of our audiences when they say, when I say, I really do believe that the world is only 6,000 years old. And so there are many Christians who accept the idea that the earth is millions or even billions of years old, and they aren't willing to accept that it's only 6,000 years old. Here is an example from a prominent theological journal that's published by the Westminster Theological Seminary. And this writer says, in the future, wrestling with geologically relevant texts such as Genesis 1 to 11. By the way, I'm thankful that he says it's theologically relevant. That's an important statement he makes. Many people just dismiss Genesis 1 to 11 as having no relevance, geological otherwise, but at least he admits that. He says evangelical scholars will have to face the implications of the mass of geological data indicating that the earth is extremely old, indicating that death has been on the earth long before man, and indicating that there has not been a global flood. Now, if you've been here through the sessions, you've heard Thomas and me repeat, I think in every one of our talks, the importance of death being after Adam's sin. You've also seen us talk about the global flood. And so this is a Christian writing in prominent theological journal who has strong disagreement with what Thomas and I have been presenting here. So why does it matter then? Because there's such differences of opinion here. Well, because these are the kinds of questions that young people have been grappling with. I don't know if the young woman is here that we were talking to before lunch from Russia, but she was passionate about how important this is, isn't it, from talks I had with her earlier. But they will raise topics like, well, couldn't God have created the earth billions of years ago and allowed it to form through the uniformitarian processes that we see happening today, and at some point along the way injected life into the forming world, and then at some point in the process, in that life, injected a rational spirit? Why couldn't God have used that? Does the presence of fossils indicate that the earth is old? This is the kind of questions that we need to grapple with. Oh, Thomas, you said in your previous one, could we fit a billions of years between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2? I'm not going to answer that question specifically today because that falls in a different presentation, but it's the kind of question related to the earth. Isn't there lots of geologic evidence that indicates that the earth is billions of years old? I want to look at some of that supposed evidence. Another question that comes up is, does the Bible even tell us how old the earth is? And it does, and I'm going to show you that. And is there any way that we can reconcile the biblical account and the geological record? And Thomas, you alluded to things like the framework hypothesis and other techniques, without going into any detail on them, where they try to reconcile these. So there are different questions that are coming up here. Isn't there a way to have both evolution and the accounts in Genesis 1 to 11? So I quoted to you that passage from the Westminster Theological Journal, and there are many Christian university professors who are actually undermining a belief in the plain reading of Genesis 1 and 2. For example, this book here, The Biblical Case for an Old Earth. I'm not showing my reader's notes here, but I think it's Baker Bookhouse, I forget, but we can look that up. Here, The Bible Rocks and Time. Davis Young is a prominent Christian evolutionist. And here, this one, Understanding the Scientific Theories of Origins. These are written by professors in Christian universities, in Christian seminaries, who are taking the completely opposite view from what CMI presents. The first two books, the ones on the left, have been reviewed on creation.com. If you're interested, you can look up the reviews and read the reviews on those. The one on the right is reviewed in the Journal of Creation. Its review isn't available on the website right at the moment, but all of them have been reviewed by our scientists, and they've given their feedback on them. But if the Earth is really billions of years old, many geologists will tell you it's roughly 4.5 billion years old, then we just simply cannot trust what Genesis 1 and 2 tells us. Because we have a situation here that God said he created in 6 days, and then immediately as we read the account, when we get to Genesis 5, he tells us Adam was created on the sixth day, and Adam was 930 years old when he died, and we have all those dates leading up, and we have a problem that doesn't fit with billions of years. And so we need to really understand what the Bible is saying, and we need to fortify ourselves and our young people to be able to face it. Now, we repeat this statement multiple times in our presentations, and that is that when God created everything on the sixth day, he concluded and he said, it's all very good. And this has a real problem if there are millions of years of fossils before Adam's sin. There is a real problem because there's death and decay and disease. And Thomas mentioned in one of his presentations that there have been examples of cancer found in dinosaur bones. There's examples of rickets. There's examples of carnivorism, animals eating animals, and so on, found in the fossil record. And this is very good. So all of this has to be after Adam's sin, because it was Adam's sin that introduced death and decay into the world. So why is it that people believe in an old earth? What is the reason? The reason fundamentally is because the odds of evolutionary processes producing the complexity that we see around us is highly remote. And if we don't have enough time for the odds to overcome the probability, then you're not going to see any life. And evolution, in theory, allows for increasing complexity, but we don't see it happening in observable time frames. There is no experimental examples of evolution actually having occurred. And if you were in my earlier presentation on evolution exploding yesterday evening, you'll see some of the problems with that. There's no operational science that shows evolution occurring. And so here is an example of this where scientists counter that these principles, that is the principles of the odds calculations, are oversimplified and inaccurate, and that the physical evidence is irrefutably conclusive. For instance, evolution took place over an unimaginably long time period, enough that the seemingly improbable aspects of evolution become probable. You see, what they've done here is, yeah, the odds of self-replicating molecules, the odds of new species developing are so incredibly remote. But if we allow for enough time, the unimaginable long ages, what happens is the improbable becomes probable. This is their argument. And so the real reason at the very bottom of why they believe in an old earth is because they need time for evolution to even be remotely possible. It's not possible, but this is it. It's not because the evidence supports long ages. That is not why they believe in an old earth. The real reason is because if they don't have an old earth, you can't have all of the evolutionary processes could have never have transpired. So we're making a series of assumptions about unobserved history. No human was present at the beginning, and these assumptions are based upon unobserved history. That's what they're doing. Nobody was there to see it, and so they're making assumptions. And Thomas, is your little quiz you did at the beginning of your presentation, two different interpretations, is very apropos for this. So let's look at an example. Thomas, you used the timer one. Take this sink. How long has it taken for the drip from the faucet to fill this sink? Well, you don't know. You walk in, you have no idea how long it's taken for the drip to fill this sink. You don't know what the initial conditions were. For example, was the sink almost full before the drip started? Has it been draining? You don't know. So how much water was in the sink before the drip? You don't know that. Likewise, it is when you're dealing with isotopes in rocks, how much of each isotope was actually present when the rock was formed? You don't know. Another question that you have to take in regard to this sink, did somebody come and turn off the faucet to turn down the drip? Has it been a constant drip rate? In nature, there are very, very few processes that are a constant rate. Very, very few. The cosmic rays vary. In fact, some people say that it's on an 11-year cycle, but it's not constant rate. Erosion depends on how much snow there was the previous winter and all kinds of other factors. Tree ring growth is variable. And so there's very few natural processes that actually have constant rates. And the interesting thing is that we have only been measuring many of these phenomena for less than 500 years. And so we don't know, even based upon 500 years, what unobserved history is, to the extent to which a system is isolated from the outside environment. And it is essentially impossible in the natural realm to isolate a system from energy inflows, energy outflows, and it's very difficult to isolate a system. But you need to know the initial conditions, the constancy, or the rate, if it's been constant, and the degree of system isolation. And so this sink, the drain could be draining, there could be sunlight coming and evaporation occurring. You just don't know if the system is isolated, and it isn't isolated. So let's take Niagara Falls as an example. How long has Niagara Falls been cutting its gorge going back? So you need to ask these questions. Well, do we start with no gorge? So at the end of the Ice Age, Lake Iroquois is covering all of what today is Lake Erie and Lake Ontario as the glaciers are melting off. And so at some point, the water in Lake Ontario fell below the Niagara Escarpment, and water started flowing out of Lake Erie into there. So we'll make an assumption there was no gorge, but at the beginning. Has it been a constant rate? In fact, it has not been, because I don't know if you're aware, but today, half of the water that flows down the Niagara River never goes over the falls anymore. It's funneled off way upriver into huge pipes that drive generating plants. So there's one factor. It's definitely not an isolated. And at the end of the Ice Age, the amount of water from the remnants of Lake Iroquois was a lot more water from the melting glaciers. And today there's a lot less water in Lake Erie, and sometimes the water level drops. And so it's not a constant rate. Is the system isolated? Absolutely not, because it depends on how much snow there was the year before and other factors that are draining out of Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. Roughly, it has been estimated that prior to the installation of those large pipes that are taking half of the water out of the Niagara River and pumping it down through the Beck generating plant, it was going back at about 1.5 meters per year, cutting through the limestone. That's pretty fast. 1.5, well, we're supposed to keep 2 meters apart, right? So 1.5 meters, that's a lot of cutting in the Niagara Gorge. And if we just assume 1.5 meters per year, then the Niagara River has cut that gorge in somewhere between 4,500 and 7,000 years at that rate, which is pretty rapid when you think about it. But it supports the Bible's time frames of the flood and the ice age, because we put the ice age roughly at 2,400 BC, roughly in that range. And so you have it probably extended over a 500-year period. But this fits within the end of the ice age and the melting of the glaciers. So let's talk about how the evolutionary scientists and geologists look at dating the rocks. And they use radioisotopic dating methods, radiometrics, and they look at the decay rates over time of these. So uranium, one form of uranium, eventually decays into lead, and as it does, it gives off, in fact, that's how one of the ways that nuclear power plants operate, but it gives off decay. Another is potassium decays into argon, and rubidium decays into strontium, and then there's carbon-14 decaying into nitrogen. I'm going to look at carbon-14 in a little more detail in a moment, but these are the four basic radiometric techniques that are used. So let's look at the assumed conditions. The relative proportions, let's take potassium, argon. Do we know how much potassium and argon was in the igneous rock when it was initially formed? Nobody was there, so how do we know? We have to make some assumptions about which was the original proportions in those. Do we know that there's been a constant decay rate over the supposed billions of years? Do we know that? And again, are there factors that could, that could have influenced the system in one way or another, and the decay rate may have changed, or more argon was introduced, or more potassium was introduced? We just don't know a lot of these things. So let's look at it from the standpoint of carbon-14. Well, carbon-14 is produced by cosmic rays that hit the atmosphere, and they take nitrogen in the air, and when the cosmic ray hits it, it ups it in its valence electrons, and it becomes carbon-14 temporarily. And living entities ingest or absorb carbon-14. The primary way that carbon-14 gets into living entities is through photosynthesis, when plants produce their plant material and they absorb the nitrogen from the air. And then the primary way that it gets into animals and humans is when we eat plant material, or if we eat meat, we could also get it from the animals, but that's the primary way that it gets into it. What happens is that when a living entity, a tree or an animal dies, there's no more carbon-14 being ingested, and the carbon-14 begins to decay it back into its original nitrogen. So the problem is, though, that we know certain things about carbon-14 and how fast it decays, and we know that it decays roughly, if you have this much carbon-14 at the beginning, in 5,700 years, you're going to have half of that. In another 5,700 years, you're going to have half again, and so on. And so it's eventually all going to disappear. The problem is that it's not an absolute measure, because the farther back you go, the harder it is to calibrate it. For example, there's these burial graves in England of 250 Vikings, and they believe they all died from an epidemic. It was probably SARS-CoV-2. They all died from an epidemic, and the date, because it's in known history, was around 870 AD. And yet with carbon 14, these bones are dated at 300 years earlier, which would put them back to 570 AD, but the Vikings weren't around at that point. So there's already, if you're going back a millennium and a half, you're off by 300 years, known from a known date compared to what the carbon 14 tells us. So we know that carbon 14, when we measure it right now, it has a half-life, but the further back you go, the more less reliable it becomes. And so it needs some form of calibration. And the method is absolutely useless beyond about 60,000 years, because all the carbon-14 would have long ago decayed by the time you reach roughly 60,000 years. And so generally, you can't get reliable results back beyond, say, 2,000 years. It's really getting out of sync. You go much farther back, and it's totally useless as you go farther back. In fact, one article, not in any way a Christian magazine, in the Telegraph said carbon dating might be wrong by 10,000 years. So it becomes problematic. For short-term, near examples, it may work. Is that accepted dates become selected dates with carbon-14, because that is, they want the date to confirm to their presuppositions. But one writer in the New York Academy of Sciences, he says, this whole thing is nothing but 13th century alchemy, and it all depends upon which funny paper you read. Now, I'm not dismissing carbon-14 totally, because in the short, near term, it may work. For instance, if you were dating the remains of a Civil War vet or something, it might have some relevance. But the further back you go, the less value it has, and it's useless beyond 60,000 years. So it can't be used to prove anything, let alone that the Earth is very old, because 60,000 years is not 4.5 billion years. So that carbon-14, we can totally dismiss from the equation. Now, when you look at the other isotopes, like uranium to lead and potassium to argon, rubidium and strontium, rubidium, you see that RISA lava examples have been tested in labs, and they give excessively old dates. For example, Sunset Crater in Arizona, the lava flows, which are in known history because the North American Indians were able to say approximately when it occurred in 1065 AD, is dated with the potassium argon method at somewhere around 200,000 years. Or this mountain in New Zealand, which exploded 300 years ago, is dated at almost 500,000 years with the dating method. I think this was potassium argon as well. This is Mount Doom. It's not called that in New Zealand, but this is the one from the Lord of the Rings movies. It was used in the Lord of the Rings. And lava flows from 1949, 1954, and 1975 were all dated from a quarter of a million to 3.5 million years. And yet we know that this lava is all within the last century was formed, and yet the dating, Hawaii, and 12 different samples were rated, and this occurred in 1800, and yet the samples are ranged from 140 million to almost 3 billion years, with an average of 1.4 billion on 12 samples. So, and then here's another one, 1980, the explosion of Mount St. Helens. Shortly thereafter, samples of the lava were dated at 350,000 years, and yet we know that it exploded in 1980, and there were witnesses to see it. I could go on with dozens of examples of these. Later, I'll show you two more of these mountain examples. But here's an interesting dilemma. The wood that was surrounded by lava, the wood was dated using carbon-14 at 45,000 years, which I'm not saying is accurate, but that's what it was dated at. But the rock around it, that formed around the wood, was dated with potassium argon at 45 million years. So which date do you pick? The igneous rock or the piece of wood, the tree that was surrounded by the lava? And here we have the volcanic activity in the Grand Canyon is dated at 100 million years, and it's sitting on top of sedimentary rock that is dated based on the index fossils at less than 5 million years. So you have something higher in the strata from a volcanic eruption that's dated 95 million years before the rock that's below it. And so these dating methods using radioactive decay, they produce useless results. There isn't, plain and simply, there is no objective independent measure in nature, careful, I say in nature, that can be used to demonstrate the age of the Earth. There isn't. There is no way that you can demonstrate how old the Earth is from natural phenomena. There isn't, plain and simply. Because the isotope ratios, when they were established, when the rock was formed, isn't a measure of time. When you know the age of the rock from the explosion and the formation of the lava, we see that the dates don't work. Here, I said there were two other examples. Mount Stromboli in Italy, 1963, dated at 2.4 million years. And Mount Etna in Sicily, 1964, dated at almost a million years. Then rocks of an unknown age, the methods are assumed to work. And then we just have to conclude that based on this evidence that no radioactive isotope dating method gives a true age for the Earth. So we have some basic assumptions here. The Earth is old, and any contrary dates are dismissed. If they find a date, like I've told you, which is inconsistent, they just dismiss it if it doesn't support the old age paradigm. This is unproven that you can do this. The method cannot be wrong, they will tell you, and unreasonable dates are dismissed. This is an arbitrary decision. The contrary evidence is dismissed as being very rare. This is rationalization and false argument. The contrary dates are rejected as being tainted. This is what's called special pleading. And then the dating method cannot fail. And this is a blind faith bias. So the whole method of using radioactive dating is really absurd. It doesn't work. And evolution accept a non-scientific approach because they cannot conceive of the method being faulty. And yet the evidence is overwhelming that it is faulty, and they just can't see it. If you'd like to see, we have both of these books out on the table there, and they support what I have been mentioning here. Rocks aren't clocks, and thousands are not billions, and these are available to you. And you can also look on creation.com. Now, I said there was no objective measure in nature, but there is an objective measure for the age of the Earth, and that is what the Bible tells us. Because in the beginning, God created. On the sixth day, Adam was created. 930 years later, he died. And then the genealogies and the chronologies are given to us in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11. They connect up with Abram, and then we can go all the way down. And you can see I've given a timeline. In this presentation, I don't go into detail on this timeline, but in another presentation on the Genesis genealogies, I get into all of these events and the biblical references and how we can connect it all up. When we get to 586 BC, which is connected with extra-biblical history with the destruction of Jerusalem, we can tie that date in to secular history, and we can calculate backward 3,412 years roughly, and we get creation around 4,000 BC. And so we do have an objective measure. God tells us how old the Earth is. He gives us the information, and it is the only, absolutely the only measure of the age of the Earth. There is no other. It doesn't exist other than what the Bible tells you. So Well, they will say, well, the strata was laid down over millions of years. It's a false conclusion. Thomas gives examples before lunch there with the trees that run through layers. The flood provides a better explanation. Coal, the claim is, well, it takes centuries for coal to form. Boy, that's a lot of coal, isn't it, in those coal seams there? But it's a false statement. Coal can be formed in a very short time, in the space of weeks to months, if you have good organic material, heat, and pressure, and coal will form. And I have the scientific references if you'd like to see that. Again, the flood provides a better explanation. This organic material is compressed and laid down quickly by the flood, and then it's under heat and pressure, and it forms into coal very fast. Then the claim was, well, the coal was formed millions of years ago, but it's false. You can take samples of coal from different parts of the world and at different depths, and you will often find, in fact, you may always find, I don't want to make it absolute, but you will often find carbon-14 in the coal. Well, carbon-14 doesn't spontaneously create meters down. It's formed by cosmic rays hitting in the atmosphere. Any carbon-14 that's left in the coal was from the original plant material, and it would have been long gone in 60,000 years. So any coal that contains carbon-14 can't be more than 60,000 years old. Well, what about stalactites and stalagmites? Thomas, you gave that, was it the cave? What was it? Carlsbad Canyon, where they said, what, 250 million years, and then eventually 2 million, then they took away the sign altogether, right? So it used to be believed that stalactites and stalagmites took millions of years to form. Do you remember how to keep stalactites and stalagmites separate? Stalactites has a C, which means it hangs from the ceiling. Stalagmites come up from below. Stalactites with a C come down from the ceiling. False statement. The basement of the Lincoln Memorial, built in 1923, was creating a whole bunch of stalactites. But here, the George Rogers Clark Monument, built in 1933. My screen is so small here, I have to look up there to read. 1933. Look at that stalactite and stalagmite that was formed. This is from limestone that was in Indiana, and they built this, and that has formed in, 50 years, 60 years? And here we have an example, and this was in National Geographic, of a stalagmite with calcium that's coming down from the roof, and there's a bat that's actually doesn't take millions of years. The flood provides a much better explanation. So is there any evidence then that the world is not billions of years old? The evidence that the evolutionists will give you doesn't prove that the world is billions of years old. The radiometric dating, the coal, the sediment layers, and all these things do not prove that the world is billions of years old. What about the other way around? Is there any evidence the world can't be billions of years old? Well, what about the missing human remains? Thomas, you used statistics. These are going to be quite consistent, but a different approach. If you take 2.1 children, I've never seen 0.1 of a child, but if you take the average person produces 2.1, mother produces 2.1 children in her lifetime, that's what's called steady state. That is, she basically deaths and births balance out over the long term. But if let's put it at 2.25, so instead of 1/10 of a child, the average mother produces 2.25 children. Let's just take that. In 60,000 years, the population of the human race would have been 21.2 trillion people based upon a 2.25. Or if you don't agree with what I'm taking, go to this website, ilkkah.com, and it's a population counter. I put in, you can slide the sliders across, you can't quite see them, but I put in the statistics assuming an original 8 people coming out of the ark roughly 4,400 years ago, 6, I used 6 because Noah and his wife didn't have any more children, at least recorded in Scripture. So we have Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives. I use the six original three breeding pairs, and I put in a rate of 2.1005. Remember, 2.1 is steady state. So we're only talking 0.05 children per couple, and in 4,400 years, we'd be at 9 billion people. Like, this is evidence that the world cannot be billions of years old. Flood ended roughly 4,400 years ago. The biblical time scale works. Here's another example of why the world cannot be billions of years old. Mitochondria are parts of our cell. In our cells, we have a nucleus and we have a separate component called a mitochondria. And inside of the, well, before I tell you about inside the mitochondria, the mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell that take our food and convert it into usable energy that the cell can use to generate new proteins and new cells. And they are so the powerhouses, like the Beck generating plant. You can see all that water coming off of the Niagara River being fed through the Beck generating plant there. We inherit our mitochondria DNA from our mothers. And the mitochondria has a separate small piece of DNA that's separate from our main genome that's in the nucleus. In the main genome is all the instructions for building new cells and for building the proteins our body needs. The mitochondria DNA is specific to the mitochondria itself. And because when the sperm and the egg combine, the sperm's portion is not taken in the combination, whereas in the main nuclear cell genome, the two sets of chromosomes merge. There's no merging of the chromosomes in the mitochondria, so we pick up our mitochondria DNA from our mothers. And we all have essentially identical mitochondria DNA. Anywhere on Earth, all of our DNA is essentially identical. There's very, very little difference in our mitochondria DNA compared with the nuclear DNA, where 99% of it's essentially identical, and the 1% is what makes for all the phenotypic variations like hair color and skin color and eye color and all those things. But in our mitochondria DNA, we are all essentially identical in that. So studies have been done on two descendants where they can get earlier DNA samples. One was from the Russian Romanov family, and the other was from veterans of the Civil War, the American Civil War, and they know the descendants. So you can imagine that in a museum in Russia somewhere, there's a hairbrush that was originally belonged to a Russian princess in the Romanov family, and we know who that woman's descendants are, and we can take a DNA sample, and we can make a comparison of them. And Ann Gibbons, writing in this article, says, evolutionary studies led them to expect about one mutation in 600 generations. That is one mutation every 12,000 years in the mitochondria DNA. And so they were stunned to find 10 base pair changes, which gave them a rate of one mutation every 40 generations, or one every 800 years. And so if a mutation occurs in a woman's mitochondria DNA, her descendants will inherit it, and then over time, maybe another mutation will occur, and basically one every 800 years or thereabouts is what they're studying. Now, and Gibbons went on to say in this article, and the reference is there if you want to look it up in Science, she went on to say that the problem is the mitochondria DNA rate is too rapid to support evolution. And she says that the measured rate indicates that the original primal Eve, and by the way, she actually uses the word Eve, not that on the earth for only 6,000 years. Well, surprise, surprise, 6,000 years supports what the Bible says. You know what then she goes on to say? But nobody believes that. So other studies have been done on mitochondria DNA. They've looked at roundworms and fruit flies and water fleas and baker's yeast. And what's interesting, when they look at all these, every single one of these with the mutations that are occurring, all give the same recent creation, not millions of years. And the genomes of these have all been decoded, and they've looked at the mitochondria DNA, and they've decoded them, and they've been able to compare and look at the mutations. And it's all around, roughly around the 6,000 years, but not millions of years. And so it's not just in humans, it's in other life forms. And then we have another indicator that the world cannot be billions of years old, and that's genome decay. We have copies of Sanford's book out on the table called Genetic Entropy. It's quite an interesting book. Sanford was not a believer. He was a professor at Cornell University. He has a lot of genetic patents. He's an expert in genetics. And later in his life, he did become a believer, and his whole worldview changed, and he started to see some of the problems with the traditional approach to genetics that the evolutionists take. And as we have indicated, and I indicated yesterday, that mutations are overwhelmingly negative. Some may be benign, but there is essentially no such thing as a positive mutation that's been kept in the gene pool that anybody has been able to put forward, other than the supposed sickle cell anemia as being positive. And mutations are accumulating in every single generation. And when I do the relevance talk, and I have this piece in it, and usually there are, if there are children there, I will say to the parents, and by the way, that means that you have mutant one below it. And these mutations are coming in to the human population at roughly 200 additional mutations in every generation are being added into the human gene pool. Now, many of them are benign. It's like a spelling mistake in a paragraph, and you can still read the paragraph. DNA has a lot of error correction built into it. God knew what he was doing when he created DNA, and proteins are able to be manufactured. However, there are approximately 1,000 genetic diseases in the human population, and they are proliferating and they are growing. Lactose intolerance is an example of a genetic defect that is increasing in the human population. That's one example. And genetic diseases are growing, and it's getting worse and worse. And Sanford predicts that in roughly 300 generations, the human race will no longer be able to produce. Now, where are we in the history? We are roughly 200 generations since Adam, roughly. Now, we don't have to worry. In the next 100 generations, Christ is going to return. We don't have to worry. God knew what he was doing, so we don't have to worry about it. But there's no way, no conceivable way, with the decay of the human genome, that humans have been on the earth 60,000 years and that our genetic information has been around for 2 million years, going back to the proto-hominids. And if you go back to a billion years to the original genetic information of the first life forms, there is no way that this is possible with genome decay. Other quick examples. The helium is produced by radioactive decay, and the current amount of helium that we have in our atmosphere could have easily accumulated in 2 million years, and scientists have no means of explaining where some of the helium leaks into space, but we know how fast it's leaking out into space. There's no way they can explain where the helium has gone if there's been billions of years of radioactive decay producing helium. Where's all the helium? Another example is the salt going into the oceans. The observed salinity of the oceans at current rates would have been produced in 60 million years. Now, the Genesis flood disrupts that. Remember, constant rates we don't necessarily accept when we're measuring these things. And the Genesis flood could have poured massive amounts of salinity in the volcanoes that were going on at that time, estimated to be roughly 40,000 volcanoes around the world, would have spewed all kinds of saline salts into the oceans. But even if it was pure water, in 60,000 years, the current salinity would have been reached at known rates of salts going in. Or looking at the current amount of material, organic material, that is coming in and put carbon into the oceans in roughly 4,000 to 6,000 years. And that makes a lot of sense from the end of the flood. These accumulation rates point to a recent creation. Another example is the bacteria that have been found and yeast that have been found in the abdominal cavities of insects enclosed in amber. And these are still viable life forms, and they can germinate today. If they had been buried 65 million years ago, their energy would have completely dissipated. There is no way that they can be 65 million years old. A better explanation is this amber was preserved in the flood. Another example, if you look in your medicine cabinet, you'll find there's something stamped on the products in the medicine cabinet, in your refrigerator, in your pantry. There's something in common that's stamped on them all, and that's a best before indicator. I don't know when the last time you saw a best before indicator of 100 years. I don't suppose any of you would be happy to drink milk that was 100 years old. It decays, and it decays fairly rapidly, particularly in the presence of heat. And yet, we've seen examples of organic material found in dinosaur bones that are claimed to be 65 million years old. It's difficult to explain how this soft tissue could have survived. And I mentioned in my dino talk this morning that in the database that we have, there have been over 50 published papers of finds in dinosaur bones of soft tissue since Mary Schweitzer's paper. The Earth simply isn't as old as evolutionists claim it to be. Dinosaur bones could not contain soft tissue remains. The pressure in natural gas and oil wells would have long ago dissipated because it's in sedimentary rock and it's porous, and eventually it would have dissipated. If the Earth was as old as evolutionists claim, these arches would have long ago eroded away, because the erosion rates would have turned them all away in less than 10,000 years. The continents would be completely flat in less than 14 million years based on known erosion rates. And yet many geologists claim that the Rocky Mountains are about 100 million years old. They would have eroded away 10 times. And if you look at the rate at which they are supposedly uplifted, it's a lot less than the erosion rate. You look at the amount of material that is being eroded off the continents, and then some of it's being subducted below the continental plate, but it's accumulating at such a rate that the oceans would be completely full and the world would be completely flat, flatter than a billiard ball, if it was billions of years old. And then we have another example. The cosmic rays are coming in, hitting this Earth, and the magnetosphere protects us from a lot of these cosmic rays. And if we didn't have it, the magnetosphere, we would be in some deep trouble, which I'll explain in a moment. But the studies were done based on archaeological digs or archaeological artifacts that were produced around 1000 AD by the Vikings, and similar techniques were applied recently, so 1,000 years later, using the same forging techniques, and you can take the magnetic moment which is formed on these iron artifacts, and they have seen a 40% decline in the magnetism in 1,000 years. And if you project it out about 1,000 years from now, there will be no magnetic protection of the Earth at all, and we would essentially fry to death. If you project it backwards on that decay curve, but going back about 10,000 years, the earth would have been so magnetic, it would be a molten mass. Now, two things on this. How do evolutionists respond to this? And the other thing is, how do Christians who are creation scientists use this? Humphrey's one of our research scientists. He looked at the, it's Humphrey's, right, Russell? Yeah. He looked at the satellite data from Mercury when a flyby occurred on Mercury, and he made a prediction based upon the magnetism of Mercury at that time, and he predicted what the magnetism would be of Mercury into the future. A later probe that went by Mercury actually confirmed his data accurately. Scientists using the magnetic decay of the Earth and knowing and applying it to Mercury, he was able to predict how much the decay would be. These magnetic moments of these planets and Earth and Mercury is decaying, and they all indicate a young age for the planets. And again, but we don't have to worry about this, because in 1,000 years from now, Christ will have returned. We're not going to fry to death. God knew what he was doing. But how do evolutionists respond? Replenishes itself. Okay, have you ever seen it happen? Is there any evidence that it replenishes itself? It rejuvenates. Well, no, but then how do you know? Well, it had to, because the earth is 3.5 billion years old, 4.5 billion years old. So it had to. Well, we have no evidence of that. The other way they respond is, well, you cannot extrapolate on those curves. Okay, I won't extrapolate on those curves, but then you can't extrapolate on your radiometric dating curves then either. Let's be consistent here. You can't use your radiometric decay curves. So other things that we'll say is, well, you know, look at the age of this, of the planet. It looks old, but there are young Earth indicators. Surtsey Island off of Iceland was formed from a volcanic eruption during the period of 1963 to 1967. When you look at it today, it looks like it has been around for millions of years. It looks mature. It has the appearance of age, but not the evidence of age. So suppose we could travel back in time. Just make a supposition. And we are in Cana of Galilee in 27 AD. And Mary comes to Jesus, and she says, they're out of wine. And so Jesus, as you know, took those big flagon, those big washing jugs, and had them fill them with water and converted it into wine. How old was the wine? When the wine taster came, he said it was the best wine he'd ever tasted, and he would swear that it had been aged, but it was only created a few seconds ago. Or on the shore of Sea in Galilee in 28 AD, how old is the bread that Jesus breaks and hands out and keeps breaking and handing out, and he feeds all these people? And how old is the fish? Well, the fish and the bread are coming into existence. And yet if you saw a baker or a fisherman, they'd tell you, well, no, that was, you know, 1-year-old fish. But so assumed age is not necessarily true age, created in a mature form, because man was created to go into a home that already was salubrious for him. And so the superficial appearance of a history of formation and of a process doesn't provide age to any measure. And God isn't being deceptive here. He says, on the fourth day I created stars, and I created the moon and the sun. And on the fifth day I created birds and trees and so on. He isn't being deceptive. He tells us what he did. And so just look at some of the examples of mature creation that are in the first few verses of Genesis. Continent having topsoil because trees could grow. There's no evidence of erosion. It appears like erosion has occurred, but it's instantaneous. God creates it with topsoil. The trees were told already had the seeds in them. The tree didn't grow and then sprout flowers and then create fruit. It's instantaneously there, but it appears to be old. The land had drainage systems. Flowing out of Eden was a river that covered the whole, went into four rivers and covered, not out necessarily out of the Garden of Eden, but out of Eden, four rivers covered the whole continent and they flowed out. The stars were visible from the earth and on. The whole creation was mature. Even Adam and Eve, as adults, were able to speak. They were able to communicate. God didn't create a zygote and then nurture it. He created mature adults. And even the zygote would have had a history behind it, because you'd have to go back to the sperm and the egg, and then you'd have to go back beyond that. How did they get there? So a mature creation is how God put it. And everything he created was all very good, because he was putting man into a beautiful paradise, and it was all ready to support life. So man's theories for explaining the origin and the age of the earth are filled with problems and difficulties, and so we either accept what God says, how he did it, or we are bowing down to Baal, and we are dealing with all kinds of conflicting presuppositions and assumptions and faulty interpretations that the world is imposing on the evidence. And Jesus tells us, but at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. At the beginning of creation. Now one fellow quipped, well, it wasn't the beginning, it was day six. Yeah, true. But it wasn't 13.8 billion years ago or 4.5 billion years ago. In fact, when modern humans arrived, somewhere around 200,000 years according to evolution. And so mankind is present only at the end of a long time frame, not at the beginning, as Jesus tells you. So is Jesus telling the truth? From the beginning, he created a male and female. Or is he telling us a lie? We have other examples, extra-biblical, that support the biblical evidence. The Irish Chronicles, having no immediate reference to the Hebrew Scriptures, no connection with them, they said the world that Ireland was colonized in what would map to 1448 BC and the 2,250 year of the world. And the Saxon Chronicles say that the world was created around 5,200 BC. Now, we hold that it was around 4,000 BC, but it's in the right ballpark. So, we have resources out there to support this. I did have deep time in my notes. I said I didn't. Sorry. We have the rocks ones I've shown you and the video that's on the back table. And we have Deep Time Deceptions. We have our Creation Answers book. And, of course, don't forget that when we have Creation Magazine, we cover this and many other topics in the episodes that come out, or the items that come out, or the articles that come out, and it's a great resource. And if you don't want to spend a penny, although we'd like you to take these resources because they're helpful, but creation.com has over 13,000 articles on it available to you. There's videos as well. I have at least the middle one. I didn't check the others, but we have these. This is Russell Humphrey right here on the right, and then and the videos. So we have videos. This one we definitely have out there, and that's by Jim Mason, who's one of our Canadian staff, and he has his PhD in nuclear physics. And he deals with this radioactive dating, which I've just been talking about. And we have that video on the back table. In fact, somebody just bought a copy of it. I saw them. So, right on time.